This is Richard Verone. I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. David White. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library at Texas Tech University. And Mr. White, I presume you are where? At home?
I'm at home.
Okay. And where is home located?
Killen, Alabama.
Okay. All right. Very good. Sir, if you could begin just telling us a little bit about your childhood, where you were born and when you were born and kind of how you grew up there. Did you grow up there in Alabama?
No. Actually, for the biggest part, I was born in Savannah, Tennessee.
Okay.
New Year's Day, 1947.
That's right. I saw a New Year's Day. Yeah. Okay.
And we lived there for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Lauderdale County.
Okay.
Lauderdale County, Alabama.
Okay.
I was raised outside in the county. My dad worked in a sawmill, and he did a little farming.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 13 years old, he bought his first cousin's
mm-hmm.
Family home in Florence,
mm-hmm.
and we moved to Florence.
Alabama. Okay. And how would you describe your childhood? Was it an ordinary childhood or anything?
It was average Southern childhood.
Okay.
You know, back in my childhood, everything was segregated.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but I knew, a few people of other races around.
Mm-hmm.
But the schools were segregated.
Mm-hmm.
I think they became integrated the year after I graduated from high school.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, you know, it was the people that had it, you know, they didn't indulge their children very much.
Right.
No one had very much.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, sort of a laid back. I went to a small county school.
Mm-hmm.
And, I had probably an average childhood. We
okay.
didn't have anything, but, you know, we had plenty to eat. You know, everyone was happy.
Right. Okay. What were your parents' occupations? You said your dad worked in the steel mill?
Well, actually, no, he worked at a sawmill, but
sawmill.
He worked at a sheet metal shop.
Okay.
From the time I was about 11,
mm-hmm.
you know, until, you know, he retired when he was about 70.
Okay.
But he worked at a sheet metal shop. And
how about your mother?
My mom was a housewife.
Okay. Did you have a job in your youth?
Oh, yeah, I sure did.
Okay.
I cut grass, and I worked as a car hot
mm-hmm.
at a little a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was 16, I went to work where my dad worked at.
Okay, so you kind of learned the business, what he was doing.
Well, I worked there until I went in the Navy as soon as I got out of high school.
Okay, so you did complete high school?
Yes.
Okay. What was your high school experience like? What were your favorite subjects in high school?
Well, usually I liked history mostly.
Okay.
That's my favorite subject in American history.
Okay. And what years here are we talking about for your high school?
I graduated in 1966.
Okay.
And I played football all 4 years.
Okay.
I went to high school, and I enjoyed that.
Okay. And so, right after high school, you enlisted in the Navy?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so you're not drafted. Why did you enlist? Was there any military experience in your family?
Well, actually, not very much. My father didn't go in because he was, I think when World War II started, he was 32.
Okay.
And I think a couple of my uncles were in the Navy
mm-hmm.
during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
But... Actually, I was planning on going to the Marine Corps.
Oh, really? Okay.
And every time I go to, I think the recruiter in the city where I live,
mm-hmm.
they had a recruiting office. They kept over a couple of days a week, and then they moved to another place.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a couple of my high school friends lined up, and we were going to join the Marine Corps.
Okay. Why the Marine Corps?
Well, I just wanted to join, I guess.
Okay.
I was matter of fact, I went down there with him. We all went down there together one day, and he wasn't there.
Okay.
So I looked for a job. It was about a month after high school. It was in June. I just said, to heck with it, and I went down there. The next day, and the guy wasn't there, but the Navy recruiter was right next door.
Uh-huh.
So I got to talking to him, so I joined the Navy. So in a couple of days later, he packed me up on a bus and sent me to Nashville, you know, to take the test.
Right.
So I did pretty good.
Okay. Okay. And in Nashville, what kind of test did you take?
It's just a, I guess, pre-induction test.
Okay.
You know, like a, probably a skills assessment test.
Okay.
Or knowledge, general knowledge test, whatever.
How long were you there in Nashville?
They sent us up there. I was, matter of fact, we spent the night. We went one day, spent the night, you know, finished up processing the next day.
Okay.
And I left, I actually left from Nashville.
Okay, where'd you go from Nashville?
I went to San Diego.
And that's where you did your basic training?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What were you, at this point in your life, what did you know about Vietnam, what the United States was doing over there?
Actually, you know, all of us were pretty gung-ho.
Okay.
In Vietnam. Matter of fact, my nephew's wife, her grandfather was killed along about this time. He went to the same high school I did.
Okay.
His name was Charles Cox. Uh-huh. I didn't know the guy. He graduated, you know, probably in 60, 59, 60, somewhere in that neighborhood. Now, mm-hmm. He got killed in November 1965.
Okay.
But some of the guys knew him and knew who he was because he'd been raised in that neighborhood.
Right.
And I know that he was the first guy that got killed from Lexington.
Okay.
And then, you know, I went into service in 66. And I had several friends in the neighborhood where I was raised, and the guys I went to high school with, that were killed in Vietnam, but I never got to attend any of the funerals or anything because I was gone for 4 years.
Okay. So, basically, you knew the United States was at war in Vietnam. You knew something.
Well, you know, I kept up with it. My dad, he watched the news or listened to it on radio or whatever every night, and I kept up with it fairly close.
Did you think that? I mean, going into the Marine Corps, you probably would go to Vietnam. How about the Navy? Did you think that you would go over there?
No, not really.
Okay.
I went in the Navy, and I was a decade when I first went on ship.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go to any A schools or whatever. And I went on, and the gunner's mate chief came by after I'd been on there about a month.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me, "Do I want to be a gunner's mate?" And I said, "Sure." So I was a seaman apprentice at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on a USS Monticello. It was a LSD-35.
Right.
And it was a Marine carrier.
Okay.
So on a Monticello, I made three trips to Vietnam.
Okay. Your training in San Diego, what can you say about that? Describe that experience.
It's regular boot camp, probably about 12 weeks.
Okay.
You had a week of mess cooking, and they kept you busy. You didn't have time to feel sorry for yourself or anything.
Right.
So, and they were on military, you know, just military life.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty hip on the schooling part of it.
Right.
And we had to wash our clothes every night. Shiner shoes, and then study, and so for all of it, they kept us busy.
Did you have a lot of physical training?
We didn't have a whole lot of physical training in the Navy.
Okay.
We had, you know, you had a lot of marching,
mm-hmm.
a lot of walking, but as far as the only kind of physical training you had, pretty strenuous physical training, was disciplinary action.
Okay. And how soon did you get into training on boats?
Oh, you're talking about from,
was that during your advance when you got on the PBR training, or?
No, see, I was already on a ship. See, I was probably, 21 years old when I went to PBRs.
Okay.
I was already in E4, see.
All right,
see,
so what that came later.
Yeah, see, okay. All the PBRs, all the guys that went to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
they were, you know, in our situation, they were all fleet sailors.
Mm-hmm.
They took these guys out of the fleet. It supposedly had a real sterling record,
mm-hmm.
that volunteered. It was supposed to be strictly volunteer.
Okay.
And I volunteered for it when we came back from a little small mini cruise in 1968.
Okay.
They sent us to Da Nang for about 2 months.
Uh-huh.
And during this time, I'd volunteered for it, and by the time we got back, I left in April of 1968.
Okay. Okay.
The Monticello, to go to PBR school in Mare Island.
Okay. So, all right. So from San Diego, you went on the Monticello, and you did short cruises there, or how many?
Actually, about all of 1967, we spent in Vietnam.
Okay. And you were off the coast? What were you?
Yeah, off the
in?
Coast. We were on, you know, the Marines had different operations that they performed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like landings and whatever.
Right.
And we supported the Marines. You know, we probably had, 400 or 500 guys on the ship.
Uh-huh.
And when we pick them up, we carry them in. They'd land, do whatever they had to do. Mm-hmm. And we was their support group.
Okay. What exactly was your detail there on that ship?
My detail was, I stood, of course, I stood gun watch during the day, and I worked on my guns.
Okay.
But my shipboard watch was a helmsman.
Okay.
I steered the ship.
Okay. Wow. How did you like that?
Well, actually, you couldn't see what was going on. All you look at was a compass.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the officer of the deck. Officer, he was telling you the courses and whatever. Mm-hmm. From up above.
Okay. What kind of weapons training had you had up to that point?
Well, I was the ship's armorer also at later on, so I pretty well knew on the ship we had all the old pre-NATO stuff. We had 30 caliber machine guns, M1 rifles, Thompson submachine guns, RAT guns, 50 caliber machine guns, BAR rifles.
Mm-hmm.
And 45 pistols, 22s, and I was pretty familiar with all of that stuff. So I pretty well knew a 50 caliber machine gun before
right.
I ever went to the boats.
Okay. Had you grown up around guns? I mean, were you familiar that way?
Shotguns and rifles.
Okay. How would you rate the training you received in San Diego? Was it adequate for you?
Oh, in San Diego, they got you ready for shipboard life. They actually didn't. It wasn't combat training.
Okay.
We got that at Mare Island.
Okay, so after you left the Monticello, you went to Mare Island?
Yes, sir.
To do your PBR training?
Did, yes.
You volunteered to do the PBR training, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And this, you've been in the Navy for how long when you did this?
Well, I went in June. Yeah, I'd been in about 2 years.
Okay.
Nearly 2 years.
What made you decide to do that versus staying on board ship?
Well, shipboard life's a little blasé, and I figured out, you know, I really believed in a war, and I wanted to make a contribution. And actually, I think if a war goes on, I think everybody secretly probably wants to know what combat's like.
Right.
And I just figured I'd go over and see what it was like.
Okay. What did your family think about that?
Well, my family didn't think too much of it.
Try to discourage you from volunteering?
Well, actually, I don't think they knew that I was in the Navy. I don't think they knew. I don't think they figured I was going to be in too much danger.
Okay. That you'd be pretty much on board ship off the coast.
Yeah.
Away from the ground fighting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Describe your training there at Mare Island. This was where, in Georgia?
Or? No, this was in California.
In California, okay. What kind of training? Describe that training.
You know, up in they've got a lot of sloughs on coming out off the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
A little old town called Vallejo, up close to up northeast of San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And I think at one time during the Second World War, Mare Island was a very, very large naval base.
Okay.
So basically about all they had when I went through was PBR training.
Okay.
And they would, they'd break us up of a morning. They'd line you up and you'd do calisthenics for about 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Then you jog 2 or 3 miles. And then you go to class.
Okay. How long were you there total?
I was there in May, June, and July, nearly all of July, and I think the last of July, I think probably the last July, 1st of August, I wound up in Vietnam.
Okay. During those 3 months, what did they teach you? I mean, when you go to class, what were they emphasizing to you?
Oh, they emphasized, we had a week of survival school, uh-huh. A week of language school,
Okay. And Vietnamese?
Yes.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I think it was, might have been 2 weeks of language school.
Okay.
And the guys emphasized to you, they had the guys that was POWs in Korean War.
Uh-huh.
And they come in, and they emphasized, they put a lot of emphasis on what you should do if you were ever captured.
Okay.
Or whatever. I think they had some unpleasant experiences in Korea.
Right.
With the young guys that were captured.
Were any of your instructors Vietnam veterans?
Matter of fact, a lot of my instructors, oh, yes, yes. A lot, mostly instructors on PR school come off the boats.
Okay. Okay. What did they tell you about combat or about their experiences in Vietnam?
The guys told you, he said on the shooting, said you had 1 to 2 seconds to make your mind up.
Hmm.
He says, when they get to shooting at you, and see, in Vietnam, you had restricted fire zones and free fire zones.
Right.
If you're not going to shoot back and you can't shoot back, you need to get the heck out of the way.
Right. Right. Did you find that true once you got over there?
Absolutely.
Okay.
They either, what we found is true is, say they built up their tactics, mm-hmm. the Americans did,
mm-hmm.
or we did, you know, as we went along.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on a, we had a guy named Bob Munzingo. He was our patrol officer.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed in ambushes of a nighttime.
Okay.
He didn't believe in getting, he believed in shooting them up instead of them shooting you up.
Right.
So they emphasized that. First patrol officer we had, you know, that I had for any length of time, he was killed in 1968 in November.
Before we get into your combat experiences there, during these 3 months, did you feel a change at all about going over there to Vietnam, or were you still, like you said, gung-ho, patriotic feeling, felt like you wanted to do your contribution, or?
No, actually, I wanted to go.
Okay.
Yeah, no time during the 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was gung-ho to go. Matter of fact, even when I got out, you know, I was never exposed to the negative part of it until, you know, I already got out of the Navy and got home.
Right. Okay. How about your fellow students there? Were they gung-ho as well? Or?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Everybody was pretty gung-ho. It was all volunteers.
Right.
You know, I imagine different guys went for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But,
How were you transported over to Vietnam?
Went on a Transworld airline.
Okay, all right. Was this an all-military flight?
Yes. It was, a matter of fact, I think it was a charter flight.
Okay.
Most of the guys off PBRs were.
Okay. Oh, you guys were together on the flight?
Yeah.
Okay. What was the mood on that flight on the way over?
Well, it's a long flight, and, you know, with the young guys, you know how the government works, GS-17, GS-15, and whatever civilians and officers and whatever get off first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they didn't pay too much attention to that. When they stopped, if you got a chance to get off, you got off.
Okay. Did you leave out of San Francisco?
Yes, we did.
And did you stop in Honolulu or?
Stopped in Honolulu.
And then where to?
And I believe we went straight into Saigon from Honolulu.
When you landed in Vietnam and got off the plane, what were you feeling? What were your thoughts?
Well, I was amazed how big the city was, you know, with mm-hmm. and all the fortifications and stuff around the airport. We went straight into Tonson Nui Airport.
Did you fly in a day or at nighttime?
We flew in during the day.
Okay.
It was, actually, I don't know. It was during the day. I think it was late afternoon when we got there.
Okay.
And then they picked us up, bused us to, I believe it's called the Montana Hotel. And we stayed there in the nighttime. And what really surprised me was, you know, probably the French built it, this big, beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
It was fortified. And the toilet facilities and showers and stuff like that went up to par.
Okay.
And also, they had bad mosquitoes.
Really? Okay. anything, what else hit you when you, that first night there? What did you think of Vietnam?
Well, there's a lot of noise. That's, you know, big city, all the honking and the motorbikes and whatever. A lot of traffic. And, you know, you could hear all of that from where we slept at.
Did the heat bother you at all?
Well, not really, because I was used to that. You know, I was raised in the southeast here. We never had air conditioning that was grown.
Okay, okay. So from how many days did you spend there in Saigon?
I think we spent a couple of days, and then they pulled us out. I think we got shots. They gave us another round of shots. And then they dispersed us to put us on a bus. And I went to a small town a few miles outside of Saigon called Nha Bay.
Okay. What'd you do there?
Went into a river division, a river section 544.
Okay. And you were assigned?
I was assigned as a gunner's mate on one of the boats.
Okay.
After a couple of days.
Now, how did you get to be a gunner's mate again? Did someone just come up and ask you, do you want to do this?
Oh, the chief came by and asked me. And I got, he was a real nice guy. I liked him. And his name was Chief Levine. I don't remember his first name, but he was, I thought he was ancient then. He's probably 35, 36 years old.
Right.
And he asked me, don't want to be a gunner's mate? And I said, sure. So he stayed after me pretty good, and I went from seaman apprentice to seaman. And then I took the third class, pay officer test, and I took it, and
okay.
I passed it.
Okay. So how soon were you on board PBR?
I want to say about a week after I got to Nha Bay.
Okay. Did you feel prepared for it?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You're still ready to go?
Yeah. Okay. And we had excellent training. I was familiar with all the weapons. You know, and they took you out and break you in, let you rab somebody for a couple of days, and then you were on your own.
What was your first boat ride like, your first mission?
Well, see, you rode the boats when we were in Mare Island.
Right.
And basically the same boat in Vietnam.
So you were totally used to that.
Yeah.
Well, your first time out on the boat in Vietnam, what was that like?
Well, the Long Tao River, we had a Rungsat special zone. I think we were patrolling the Long Tao River. And the river section I was in was only formed in May of 1968. So they'd been May, June, July, and they'd only been in existence for a couple of months.
Okay.
So when I got there, you know, they were still moving people around. You know, trying to reach an identity. And during this, also during this time, they were establishing so many new river sections, river divisions, that they were, you know, they would take the older hands and move them out to a new one, and then get a new flux of, influx of new hands. So actually, probably a couple, 3 months, I was pretty settled in.
Okay. How do they introduce you to the missions? I mean, do they kind of broke you in slowly to that stuff, or did they?
You were a couple of days, and they bring the boat captains and the patrol officer in and brief them. And on the patrols, you had a 12-hour patrol, off 12, on 12, and then off 24.
Okay.
So you have 2-day patrols, off 24, and then 2-night patrols.
Okay.
So, and I've got the patrol reports for August, and so I got there, you know, about the 1st of August, but I made 25 patrols in the month of August.
Wow. So you really did jump right into the action.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then August, September, October, and November the 8th, everything was pretty quiet how the rung set. You know, not real bad. You know, you get a guy wounded every now and then. Matter of fact, the first guy that got killed out of our river division, it was on our boat.
Really?
And he was killed November the 8th, 1968.
What had happened on that mission?
We had been a blocking force up on the river, I think, from and they sent us in some little inlet.
Mm-hmm.
And we got in there, used us as a blocking force, and, you know, I think some Vietnamese Marines or whatever. And as we were coming out, mm-hmm. they had bombed that place. As we was coming out, we got ambushed.
Okay.
And the boat that I was on took a couple of rockets, and the chief was on the other boat.
Mm-hmm.
And he came over there and got on our boat because our boat captain got hurt pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he got on there, we took another rocket, and he got killed. He took one right straight in the head. And he probably hadn't been on there just a few seconds when he...
Mm-hmm.
And then we...
How many boats were on patrol?
Two.
Okay.
You always had a... the lead boat and the cover boat.
Okay.
Usually the patrol officer rode on the lead boat.
Right, right. Well, can you describe your typical mission?
Well, the typical mission is according to... you know, we could either insert some Vietnamese Marines or operate with them of a night time, or a group of Americans, American Rangers, or the Navy SEAL teams, or whatever they had you set up to do. And then you, a lot of times, if we didn't have anything special to do, we just had a patrol sector.
Okay.
Where in the daytime, you patrolled it. And then there for the first few months, you know, of a night time, we also patrolled.
Right. What were you looking for when you say patrol?
You know, they had a curfew from like 6 in the evening to 6 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we was looking for some curfew violators. And, you know, we get out on the river if you've seen any traffic during the day.
Mm-hmm.
We checked the identification cards.
Okay.
And checked the sampans and junks for contraband.
Mm-hmm.
That's a sort of like a river police.
Right. How did the local Vietnamese react to this when you guys would, you know, stop and search? And were they, I mean, did they expect this?
Yes, they expected.
Okay, so it was almost routine?
Yeah, it's almost routine.
Okay.
You know, it's sort of like you stand in the line at the airport.
Okay.
You don't like it, but there's not very much you can do about it.
Right.
And that's, most of those people, you know, they're pretty nice people. And
right.
People, you know, their main mode of traffic was river traffic
right.
in the Mekong,
right
south.
I read in your questionnaire you said you did get an aerial view of your area of operations. It was mainly water.
Yeah.
Just flat out water. What did you think of the overall mission for the United States Navy down in the Delta there to kind of plug up, you know, the game wardens, Operation Game Wardens, and plugging up those... all those waterways. Did you think that was viable once you had been there and seen it and seen how much water there was?
Oh, yes. I think so. I think the Navy did an excellent job.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I think, you know, I'm not patting myself on the back because I was in the Navy, but as far as personnel and training and mission accomplished and whatever, I think probably the Navy did the best job of anybody.
Okay. Did you ever see or meet Admiral Zumwalt?
Matter of fact, I did.
Really?
I got a Purple Heart on November the 8th when the chief got killed.
Uh-huh.
And we were in, USS Harnett County up on Operation Giant Slingshot. And I think this year was in early January of 1969. And he came on and presented me with a Purple Heart.
What were your impressions of him?
I think Zumwalt, you know, I think he was a great man. I think he's a great admiral. And I think he really got the ball rolling when he took over.
Right. That's
1968.
That's what a lot of folks say. I've heard that a lot, and a lot of historians have said that as well. That things really picked up pace when he came on board and took over.
Yeah, I think he took over in September 1968, and that's when things picked up.
How would you describe the Vietnamese people, the regular civilians first?
The regular civilians, I think they were you know, the people we came in contact with was the farmers, and mostly farmers. But they were very good people. Sort of passive. And even the language school we went to, you couldn't, you know, different dialects and whatever.
Right.
Had a hard time communicating with them. Right. But, and the people, you know, we had maids in their barracks. But they were good people.
Okay. How would you describe the enemy?
Well, the enemy, they were tough and tenacious.
You fought mainly Viet Cong there in the Delta. Did you ever run into any of the regular army?
Yeah, I think probably up on the Cambodian border when we was up on Operation Giant Slingshot. I think we run into a lot of the regular army.
Okay.
North Vietnamese army.
Okay.
See, they only had a few miles come right out of Cambodia.
Right, right. You said they were tenacious. What else?
Well, they were tenacious and inventive because they could, you know, they had a hard time with the supply lines, but they could deal you some misery.
Such as what? Can you give me an example?
Oh, you talk about setting up ambushes and whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, they'd dig a hole in the ground. They'd wait for the tide to get down where the 50s wouldn't reach them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd zero in on you, pull them rockets to you.
Hmm. What were you? Do you think the enemy's strengths were?
Home ground.
Right.
Yeah. Problem.
Yeah. How about weaknesses?
Probably supplies, munitions.
Just not get enough stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. So what were your experiences with combat like? You said immediately in August you did 25 missions. Did you see combat immediately there?
After a couple of weeks.
What was that like from the boat's standpoint? Most people, when they think of the Vietnam War, they're thinking, you know, on the ground, you know, fighting like that. What was combat like on those boats?
Well, when you see what a rocket would do to a boat,
mm-hmm.
and you're riding down a river about 40, 50 feet wide,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of scary.
You talking about like a shoulder-held rocket?
Yeah.
Okay. And now, would the PBRs withstand? How many rocket shots could it withstand?
I don't know. That one in November, we took several of them.
Okay, in the hull?
Yeah. See, they're made out of fiberglass.
Right, right.
And some of those things, it was hard to sink one.
Was that their main weapon against you, the rocket?
Yeah, probably the rocket.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Probably a RPG round or a B-40.
Right. Now, on the boat itself, where were you stationed?
Our training trained us to do everything on the boat.
Okay.
You know, except for overhauling the engine. But we had engineman for the engines.
Mm-hmm.
And on the big maintenance activities,
mm-hmm.
they had cranes pull the boats out of the water and put them in the shop.
Right.
They had fiberglass people. They had maintenance people to do that. But my biggest job, I took care of all the weapons.
Okay.
And I handled the forward 50s most of the time. But we had a four-man boat crew. We had a boat captain.
Mm-hmm.
And he could be either second class, first class, sometimes even third class.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a third class gunner's mate or second class, and then same way with an engineman, either third or second. And then seaman to take care of the boat. Engineman took care of the engineering part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And boat captain took care of all the charts,
mm-hmm.
radios, and he usually drove the boat. And gunner's mate took care of all the weapons, grenades, and the seaman kept the boat cleaned.
Okay.
But anybody could flip-flop.
Okay. I imagine that was very important to do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Say, all of us was taught to drive the boat, and all of us taught to use the radios.
Mm-hmm. Were the boats easy to handle?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, they basically took these motorboats developed on the east coast of the United States and of the fiberglass type and just put them in the rivers there in the Mekong. And the basic take on this was that it was really ingenious to do this, these very shallow draft, fast-moving, very versatile boats.
Well, a lot of people think this here was a... this was not a pleasure craft. It was strictly a war boat.
Well, of course, right.
And they had 2 6-cylinder diesel engines on them.
Uh-huh.
And they had and they run off of pumps.
Mm-hmm.
And the pumps blow the water out, water jets.
Right.
And you got your propulsion, and you're steering from the pumps.
Right.
And they were heavily armed. The most of the boats we had had 2 M60s on them, on each engine cover.
Mm-hmm.
You had 2 forward 50s.
Mm-hmm.
You had an after 50 with a Honeywell Mark 18 grenade launcher mount on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
3 M16 rifles and 2 M79s that shot the 40 millimeter grenades.
Right.
And actually everybody was a gunner except the guy that was driving.
Right. Of those weapons, which was your favorite one? Which one did you like to have?
Oh, I liked the 50 the best.
Right. That's the one you were on that the most, you said.
Well, that's the one that was most dependable.
Okay.
You get the head spacing and the timing set on the 50, and you just keep on shooting.
Right. Were you on the lead craft a lot, or did you rotate back to the support craft?
We probably rotated.
Okay. How did it feel being the on the 50 up there in the front lead boat going up a river? Did you get used to that? I mean, is that something?
Yeah, you probably, it seemed like if nothing ever did happen, if you was apprehensive about it, by the time you relaxed, that's when everything started happening.
Okay.
So it was hard to get comfortable and hard to relax.
Right. Did you prefer night missions or day missions more?
Well, actually, I preferred the night missions later on.
Why was that?
Because we never did patrol. We'd set up ambushes.
Okay. And can you describe one of those?
Sure.
A typical ambush?
You'd sort of catty-corner across from each other boats, get a good feel of fire for both boats.
Mm-hmm.
One drift in to cut your engines off.
Mm-hmm.
Drift into the bank. Just reach up and grab a branch or something, tie into it,
mm-hmm.
and you just sit there, wait for somebody to come along.
And when they did?
And when they did, they usually get the worst end of the deal.
Right. How did you know that when you drifted over the shore, we were apprehensive about who might be right there on the shore?
I mean, No, not really, because, that jungle foliage is so rough,
mm-hmm.
so thick.
Mm-hmm.
The places that hadn't been sprayed, they hadn't sprayed a whole lot down there where we were at.
Right.
Some of it in 68. But you just drifted in there and grabbed something. And see, the boats were painted about the same color, so mm-hmm. they blended in fairly well.
Right, right. And how often would you do these night ambushes?
Probably later on. In late 68 and early 69, about every patrol.
Okay.
You know, the Army had this heat sensors.
Mm-hmm.
They could pick up body movement, and they relayed that information to our headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And they pretty well knew where they wanted you to set up ambushes at.
Okay.
Where they had a lot of movement.
Right. So when you set these up, then you are expecting... You didn't set them up just randomly. You set them up where they had told you where to expect some movement.
Well, that was my information. That was my understanding. But see, I was an E-4. I was a gunner's mate, and we weren't real privy to a whole lot of decision making process.
Right, right. Well, I think a lot of people, at least the ones that I've talked to, if they're not a historian who's actually studying what went on in the Mekong Delta, their image of the PBR and that kind of riverine warfare was from the movie Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, but that's actually it wasn't nothing like it.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you. What do you think of that representation?
I see apocalypse now, but I don't have much faith in that.
Why?
Well, the whole process of it.
Okay.
You know, all the crazies and dope smokers and
potheads
and whatever.
Right.
Most of our guys were. You know, we had guys that drank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the guys have been in for any length of time.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them drank, but they wasn't real big on the dope and stuff.
Did you guys stay pretty squared away when you're on mission?
Yes.
Okay. Was there a lot of drinking or alcohol abuse that you saw?
No, actually, there wasn't no alcohol abuse, but see, the water was so bad.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the evaporator, I don't know where they made the fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
It had a salt tinge to it.
Right.
About the only way I could ever drink the water was drink it, make coffee out of it.
Okay.
And then it still had that old brine flavor.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we drank beer. They didn't say nothing about drinking a soft drink or beer.
Right.
But they ain't nobody abused anything. You got to keep yourself pretty straight.
How about drugs? Do you see a lot of drug use or not?
No. Not really. You know, some of them guys from big cities probably used to it. They might smoke a joint or something sometimes.
Right.
But, I didn't really see that much drug abuse.
It said, you answered in your questionnaire that you had received two Purple Hearts, is that correct?
Yes.
Can you describe what happened on those two separate occasions?
Well, one of them was when on November the 8th.
Right.
We took all the rockets.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody on the boat got wounded. Matter of fact, we was taking some of the new guys out.
Okay.
And I believe at the time that the chief got killed, I think it was six guys on our boat at this time.
Wow.
You know, one of the new guys that we were breaking in,
mm-hmm.
he got wounded. The engineman got wounded. Seaman got wounded bad, and the boat captain got wounded real bad, and the chief got killed.
Did you take shrapnel? Or?
Yeah, shrapnel.
Okay. Whereabouts?
I got shrapnel in the back, and where it hit the fiberglass, I got fiberglass back pretty good.
Wow.
And,
okay. How about the second Purple Heart?
The second Purple Heart... We was using a runabout to set up ambushes.
Mm-hmm.
We was just coming off the ambush, and we was with two PBRs.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran off and left them, and the guy pulled the boat back dead in the water. We were about 10 feet from a bank,
mm-hmm.
and they hit it with a rocket, and it blew up my face.
Mm.
Matter of fact, probably the rocket didn't even go off. If it had, a concussion would probably have killed me.
Were you... evacuated out of the area?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was evacuated to Saigon, then a couple of days later I was sent to Japan. And I came home after that.
Oh, really? So that was it for you?
Yeah.
What happened to you physically? Did?
Well, outside of getting my feelings hurt and being depressed and being scared, I thought I'd lost my eyesight.
Oh, really?
Because the flash burnt my eyes.
Uh-huh.
And I got a big split down across my forehead.
Mm-hmm.
I had shrapnel in my left hand and up and down my right arm. Mm. And I took a heck of a concussion right in my face.
Right.
And I was sore for several days after that, and I couldn't get around good. And it burned all my hair off.
Really?
Burnt my eyelashes off, my eyebrows.
Mm.
And burnt the right side of my face pretty good.
Were you able to recover from this?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. So you're okay today?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. What kind of contact did you have with Arvin?
Oh, the Arvin people?
Yeah. Or the Vietnamese Navy?
Well, actually, we didn't have too much contact with the Vietnamese Navy. We probably were closer with the Army than we did with the Navy.
Okay. What was your impression of Arvin?
I don't know. You know about all we did. I don't think they were too disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them. I'm sure some of them were excellent soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
I might not say that. We had a kid in the, I believe it was September, October 1968.
Mm-hmm.
they were inserting a bunch of Arvins. And they take those frag grenades and put a big wide rubber band around them.
Right.
And pull the pin on them.
Right.
So they had a bow full of those Arvins.
Uh-huh.
One of the guys dropped a grenade, and the kid was in the gun tub. He come out for it, and then all the Arvins reached for it.
Right.
And I think the guy named Spiller, I think it blinded him. And he got hurt pretty bad.
Did you think they lacked poor leadership or discipline or what?
Actually, I can't say because I wasn't in the know enough, you know.
Right.
Probably some of the guys that were advisors and stuff. See, all we did, we inserted these guys.
Right.
When they called for us, we'd come and get them.
Right.
That was about our extent of them.
Like a taxi service almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah. Sort of like a cover boat, you insert them, then you go back out, and then when they holler at you to come back in, pick them up, we go back in, pick them up.
Okay. What was life at the base like?
Well, actually, life at Knob A was pretty nice. They had a nice chow hall.
Mm-hmm.
They had a fresh milk,
mm-hmm.
Long sandwich line. It opened 24 hours a day. You get about anything you want to eat.
Wow.
Excellent food. Living conditions for the PBRs in Knob A were really good.
Okay.
But when we went to the Harnett County and operate off it,
mm-hmm.
the food was good, but, you know, you didn't have as big a selection as you did off the base.
Right.
And
were you well equipped? I mean, you answered some of the question, your questionnaire that you had a lot of equipment. You basically had your pick of your boats were well taken care of.
Oh yeah, they were. Yeah, we had excellent maintenance facility,
mm-hmm.
both on the Harnett County and at Knob A. The boats were well cared for.
Mm-hmm.
They were well maintained.
Mm-hmm.
We had excellent leadership, and you know, most of the guys were probably average age on the PBRs were probably it was very, very old for a combat outfit.
Really?
You know, most of the younger guys were 20, 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's probably two-thirds of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the chiefs. And you have the chiefs and officers.
Right.
Most of those were probably 25, 26. Say some of the chiefs were over 30. Some of the chiefs third class were over 30 years old.
Really? Okay.
So the average age, you know, rounded out probably to, I'd say, 24, 25 years old.
That is older than what was on the ground.
Yeah.
As far as American forces are concerned.
Yeah. Because, and see, most everyone on the boats was a petty officer.
Right. Right. You said you described the leadership you had as really good. What about overall American leadership in Vietnam?
Well, from a Navy standpoint, I think we had excellent leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Even on the ships I were on, mm-hmm. I was on USS Monticello.
Mm-hmm.
I think officers and shipboard duty was very, very good.
Okay.
It was excellent, and of course everything I've seen in the Navy in Vietnam, they did an excellent job.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
As far as you know, as far as all preparation, execution,
mm-hmm.
and taking care of the people.
What did you think of overall American policy in Vietnam?
I wasn't too enthused with the overall American policy. Yeah, so sort of like dumping in one hand, whapping with the other one. They ain't nobody could really make their mind up what they wanted to do. And I think everyone understood that at that time.
Did that affect morale?
Well, really not on our unit. You know, you get a lot of negative statements about, I know in 1968,
mm-hmm.
I was, and I think most of the other guys was proud to see President Johnson leave.
Why is that?
Well, I think he was too wishy-washy.
Okay. And did you guys think that Nixon was going to do something really different?
Well, yes, I did, really. But I think he probably handled it about as good as he could.
Right. How much were you able to keep up with news back home in America?
Oh, we had a TV in our den.
So you were...
Oh, you walk into the barracks at Nabe.
Right.
We had a rec area where we had a TV. You even got the ball games. You got them a week late. You know, they used to have a week of the ball game.
Mm-hmm. Like the NFL and
Well, college games, yeah, college. Uh-huh. And so, actually, you could, if you want to do anything, you go in. Probably the Armed Forces TV network.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were showing NBC, CBS, or ABC.
Right.
So, and you know, we had Stars and Stripes magazines.
Right.
And probably some of the Navy magazines, Navy News and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've always liked to read, so I kept up to date pretty well.
Right. Did you ever encounter any problems with the media coverage there while you were in Vietnam?
Actually, I have. I never ran across anybody in the media.
Really?
If I did, I didn't know who they were.
Okay.
So,
what do you think of media coverage overall with the Vietnam War?
I wasn't too enthused about it. You know, matter of fact, I'm not too enthused about it right now.
Right.
I think it's hard on anything now. We live in such a diverse society,
mm-hmm.
that anything is straight, true, and narrow.
Mm-hmm.
You've either got flip-flop off, on, whatever.
Right.
Nothing is right and wrong. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So people's got to make their own opinions. You know, you've got a good education. You could pretty well make your own opinion about what to do.
Right. How much religion was there in the field there with you in Vietnam?
Actually, quite a bit.
Really?
The guys that we got killed,
mm-hmm.
they always held a memorial mass for them.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd always either have a priest or a lay preacher or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come in and a military chaplain.
Okay.
Usually a Navy chaplain. They'd come in and hold it for you.
Right.
So, and usually, if I'm not badly mistaken, I think on Sundays that they always had either a mass or a church,
mm-hmm.
church of some kind,
mm-hmm.
at Nabe on Sundays.
So you had opportunity to attend services?
Absolutely.
Okay. Did you attend them?
Not very rarely. Mm-hmm. I always attended memorials, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of Navy chaplains around Nabe?
I think there were. You know, they had ones. They had one assigned in certain areas, and I seen chaplains several times. So, I don't exactly know how many there were.
You had access to them if you wanted to?
Yes.
Okay. Were there any counselors available to you guys at Nabe?
Counselors?
Yeah, just in case you needed to, you had combat stress or what have you. Were you able to talk with somebody, professional, if you wanted to?
I'm sure that they could probably have loaded you on a bus and sent you to Saigon.
Okay.
If need be.
Right, right. How much contact or did you see with disease? You know, one of the main concerns of the Americans making the policy was malaria, and you're right there, you know, in this very heavily mosquito-infested area in the Mekong Delta. What kind of exposure did you have to any kind of disease?
Well, we had a lot of mosquitoes, but I don't think we had very many people to get sick with malaria.
Did you ever get sick?
No.
Did you take your malaria pills every day? Or?
Well, I think we got shots, and, I think they gave us pills and stuff.
Right.
And we pretty well took our medicine.
Okay. What'd you guys do for entertainment?
Well, we drank, listened to music, watched TV, played cards, gambled.
Right.
And I think they had movies there. And if you went on patrol when we was in Nob Bay, from four in the evening to eight at night, you could go into the town of Nob Bay.
Okay. What would you do there?
Chasing women. And drink, shoot the breeze, get your clothes pressed and whatever.
Right. Did they have good bars there in Nob Bay?
Not really. Bars were set up to relieve the sailors of the money.
Okay. What was your typical night there in Nob Bay like?
We had barracks and had rooms partitioned off, two guys to a room. So usually in my room, you know, I had my stereo, I had a small refrigerator, and of course right across the road we had a chow hall where you could eat anytime you wanted to. So usually we get together and we play cards, play poker, gamble, drink beer, TV sometimes.
Did you ever take any R&Rs?
I took an R&R. I took a week in Bonktown and when I got hit in November.
Okay.
68.
What'd you do there in Bonktown?
Drank, went out on the beach, walked up and down the beach, and just lazed around for a week.
Right. Did that relax you, or did you miss being with your buddies?
No, I enjoyed it.
Okay. Did you ever see any USO shows?
I don't remember seeing a USO show. I seen one USO show, but that was in San Diego in 1967, I believe.
Okay.
It's Flip Wilson and I can't think of the guy's name. The older, I get no respect.
Oh, Dangerfield?
Yeah, Rodney. He's good.
Okay.
I seen him and Flip Wilson at a USO show.
I bet that was a funny show.
Yeah, it was.
What kind of wild animals did you guys see there?
We seen mostly those lizard type things. I forget what they call them.
Geckos?
Yeah, sort of like geckos.
Okay.
But I don't think they call them lizards. Geckos. I think they some kind of. We seen several of those. And a lot of poisonous snakes.
Where did you see those? Were they at base?
They had a lot of water snakes.
Right.
Yeah. Had a lot of water snakes over there.
Did anybody ever get bitten that you know of?
Matter of fact, I think one guy after I left, I seen it on the internet where he got bitten, but it was a non-poisonous snake.
Okay. Where did you see these? When you were out on patrol and... And hanging in the trees and things like that?
Yeah, usually on the bank or swimming in the water or whatever.
Right. Did you guys ever disembark when you're out on patrol and get off on the bank? And
Yeah. Several times we did. We had something we wanted to check out.
If
we wanted to, we'd go on the bank.
What would you do? I mean, you just...
We just pull up on the bank, and you just jump off the bow of the boat and go about whatever you was going to do.
Was that... one person would stay with the boat, and the other three of you would?
Well, usually you'd have a couple of guys, and then the rest of them stay at the boat.
Okay. Did you ever have any trouble, any contact with the enemy when you did that?
No.
Okay. Did you guys have any... I'm sorry, go ahead.
If you thought there was any possibility that you had contact with the enemy, you wouldn't go on the bank.
Right. Right, I can imagine. How about the country itself? What did you think of Vietnam itself?
Vietnam was a beautiful, beautiful place. It's sort of like the Philippines.
Right.
You know, I'm talking about climate and whatever. But and it's, you know, just a tropical paradise.
Would you ever want to go back?
Not really. I'd like to go to Hawaii, but I don't have much of a desire to go to Vietnam.
Right. Did you ever get exposed to Agent Orange or come in any kind of contact with that?
Now, I'm sure that we probably You know, they did a lot of spraying in 68 and 69.
Yes, sir.
And up there on some of the rivers, especially when we went on Operation Giant Slingshot, they sprayed the heck out of those banks.
Right, right.
So I'm sure that we probably came in contact with it.
Have you had any problems at all that you know of?
Not really that I know of. I don't know. You know, I don't know what all the problems are, but as far as I have no cancers that I know of and whatever.
Okay. Were there any race issues that you were aware of?
Well, that's when they was having a little bit of racial trouble in 68 and 69.
Yes.
You know, they I think a Democrat National Convention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But not really. We only had we had a few blacks in our river division, but they were squared away guys, straight up. Man, most of them was, you know, pretty good people.
So no incidents that you're aware of?
Yeah, you know, and of course we had a few of the redneck guys too, but most of them, you know, like the guys from down south, if, you know, if I knew a black guy, I was friends with a couple of them.
Right.
I got along good with them.
Right.
As a matter of fact, the seaman on our boat was a black guy, and he was a friend of mine.
Okay. Did he make it out?
I hadn't heard from him in several years. I don't know whatever happened to him.
Okay. Okay. Were there any discussions or incidents of fracking?
You know, I never heard that tale until I'd already got out of service. I never heard that. You talk about getting rid of people you didn't like. But as many books as I've read in the last few years, you know, I've come across it several times, but I never heard it when I was in service.
Okay. Okay. What was the bravest action that you witnessed there in Vietnam?
Well, probably the bravest action. You know, it took a lot of guts for everybody, you know, to go out.
Right.
And up and down the river.
Right.
And, you know, when things got pretty hot, everybody filled in done their job. So, you know, you can't, the things that I've seen personally, so actually you can't put one guy above another because, you know, everybody, when things got hot and, things got pretty tenacious. Everybody chipped in. They did their job well.
Okay. If you could change anything about your experience there in Vietnam, what would it be?
Well, you know, I hate to see the guys that got hurt bad, and I hate to see the guys that got died. That's the only thing that I hate about my experience, but I think it's been a good lifetime experience for me.
No regrets about doing what you did?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I think we did a wonderful job. And at the time, I think we did a job that needed to be done.
Okay. Okay. How did you leave Vietnam? That's when you were in Japan, right? And you were evacuated out?
I was evacuated out, and I stayed in Japan about 6 weeks, and I left Japan on an airplane and flew back in San Francisco, and then flew from there home.
So how long were you actually in country?
I looked at that the other day. I was over there a little over 8 months.
Okay. Did those 8 months go fast for you, or did they seem to go, you know, drag by?
When you're 20, 21 years old, everything drags by.
Yeah.
So,
what was your flight back like?
I had a reaction from some medicine I had in the hospital, and they bought me a new blue uniform. See, we stored all of our uniforms. We wore nothing but jungle green when we was over there. So when I got back to Japan, they bought me some clothes, and I put on that travel uniform. I put on that blue uniform, and I got a reaction off that wool. And I itched all the way from Japan to San Francisco. And I got out and I went into the airport, went into a little old airport store.
Right.
And I bought me a bottle of rubbing alcohol. And that's the biggest relief I have ever had. Everywhere the wool touched my skin, I got a bad skin rash.
Wow. So that was a miserable flight back across the Pacific.
That was a miserable flight.
Were you in a seat, or were you still laying down? Or?
I was in a seat.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of reception did you have at the airport?
Pretty uneventful. Matter of fact, we flew in. I was under the understanding that I just flew in, and I think I got me another flight. Got me a flight home, and actually, I don't really remember it much now. But at this time, the military people weren't held in too high esteem, so
right.
They didn't bother you too awful much.
Right. Did you have any difficulty transitioning back into civilian life?
Yes, I did. I had real bad for 3 or 4 years, 2 or 3 years, whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had a pretty rough time.
Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, it's hard to get, you know, it's just hard to go back out. Matter of fact, I had a hard time. See, I went back in the fleet when I came back for probably. I got back in April, May, probably about 7 or 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a hard time, you know, just going back out, going to work in there. But, I don't know, it's probably depression.
Okay. Did this start, you know, when you got back home, basically, before you went back out with the fleet?
Yeah.
How did your family react to you when you got home?
Oh, my family was glad to see me.
Yeah.
You know, all my friends were glad to see me. Matter of fact, my next-door neighbor, and right about the time I left to go over there, mm-hmm. He was killed May the 25th of 68.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I was going through PBR school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the hospital in Japan longer than I anticipated. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't wrote my mom, I called her.
Right.
And she wrote someone trying to find me.
Right.
And she got a little bit ill. My mother did when she found out I was in the hospital and they hadn't notified her.
Right.
But I'd put down not to notify my parents unless so.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I absolutely thought it was necessary.
Uh-huh. Why? To protect them?
Yeah. You know, keep their anxiety down, whatever.
Right.
I got home, and my parents, you know, they took it pretty good.
So how long before you went back out with the fleet?
After I got home?
Yes, sir.
Probably about 2 weeks.
Wow, pretty quick.
Yeah.
And you were gone, what, another 7 or 8 months, you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I came home on weekends.
Okay.
So I went on ship. I went on the Vermilion out of Newport News.
Mm-hmm.
And our deck officer told us, gunner's mates and boatswain mates went in together.
Mm-hmm.
And he just came down and told me, he said, hey, anytime you want to go in on weekends, he said, you come tell me, I'll write you a special liberty chit.
Okay.
You leave out on Thursday and come back on Tuesday.
Okay.
I said, man, that's great. They looked out for me good.
Was that because they knew you had been in country over in Vietnam? Or?
Yeah, that's because they knew I'd been over there.
Did you encounter other Vietnam veterans who had done their tour? And
no, actually, not very much in the Navy.
Okay.
You didn't see on the East Coast. See, I came back from Vietnam, and I went straight to the East Coast.
Right.
And you didn't see a whole lot of those guys over there.
Okay. So when you finally got out of the Navy. How difficult was it for you to transition to civilian life permanently?
It was pretty bad. I would probably pretty bad for a couple of years, cause you know, I guess too much drinking and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I got straightened out.
Okay.
Long about 73, 74. I got married in 74.
Great, great.
I had a child.
Mm-hmm.
So I stretched it out pretty good.
That helped you out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you, before that time, was it post-traumatic stress disorder, do you think? Or were you reliving your experiences in Vietnam, or were you just having difficulty relating to people, or what was that?
Probably a little bit of both.
Okay.
See, the bad thing about the guy that relieved me on the boat, see, I left February the 26th. Gunner's mate that relieved me on the boat that I was on.
Yes, sir.
He got killed, I think, about the first part of April. Mm. I don't know the exact date. I think sometime about the, I think it's 9th of April.
Mm-hmm.
So, see, I'd only been gone 5 weeks, and my replacement got killed. And I wrote our operations officer. I wrote him a letter.
Yes, sir.
When I got on Vermilion. Mm-hmm. And see, rarely you find out, you didn't find out what happened to other people. And they didn't know what happened to you, you know, when you left.
Right.
But I wrote him a letter, but I wanted him to sell my refrigerator and, you know, my stereo and all my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And send me the money.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me a check back, or sent me the money back, and he told me about the guy getting killed. You know, I felt bad about that.
Did you feel guilty about that?
Yeah, I felt a little bit guilty. Because, you know, actually I could have went back if I'd wanted to, but I decided not to.
Why did you decide not to?
Well, you know, I was depressed a little bit. My mom, she was raising Cain with me.
Uh-huh.
And another kid on there, he'd been wounded before.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd went back, and he hadn't been back long, and he got killed. Mm. So, and we were losing guys, I'm talking about. And December and January and February, 68 and 69,
mm-hmm.
on that Operation Giant Slingshot,
mm-hmm.
I imagine we had, you know, most guys you was going to have out on the river at one time was probably 18 people. And I think we had 35, 40 people wounded. Mm. A couple of guys killed.
Mm-hmm.
I guess three guys killed, three or four guys killed,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of guys wounded during this time. So that December, January, February was really, really, really bad months.
Right. So you decided you did not want to take your chances again?
Well, they gave me my choice, you know. If they'd sent me back, I'd have went back.
Right.
But when they give you a choice, It takes a pretty tough guy, really a dedicated guy, to go back. And I don't guess I was that dedicated. Probably fear and common sense.
Right. I don't know if it has anything to do with your dedication. It might just be your common sense and your experiences too.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a couple questions just about U.S. policy. When you got back, the United States still fully involved in the war. What did you think about that? I mean, I know you served out your 7-8 months, but when you got out of the Navy, did you not keep up with what was happening in Vietnam, or did you?
Yeah, sure did. Yeah, I kept up with it all the time.
What did you think about U.S. policy?
I didn't have much respect for U.S. policy at the time.
Okay.
Actually, what I think. They were scared they were going to get another China.
Right.
And
meaning like Korea?
Yeah.
If they went all out, mm-hmm. the Chinese would come in?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's disheartening when you think you've got an excellent military.
Right.
And you think you're doing an excellent job, and they put a leash on you.
Right.
So basically That's what I thought of it.
What do you think the United States could have done differently?
The United States could have done differently.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they should have made Vietnam more responsible for a lot of stuff.
let the Vietnamese take care of business more?
Yeah. If they'd I think they tried to meddle in the internal affairs too much in South Vietnam, you know, in the probably early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if they let the Vietnamese take care of it, that, and you know, give them support, give them a lot of support, I think they would probably have been a lot better off.
Okay. What did you think of the policy of Vietnamization? That was basically in 1973, turning the war back over to the Vietnamese.
I think it was a little bit too late for that. All the material and men and probably, well, you're pulling 500,000-600,000 people out at one time.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty good size army to pull out.
Yes, it is.
To replace. And see, when they did that, you know, we turned all of our boats over, if I'm not badly mistaken, about 1970.
Yes, sir.
See, the Navy was probably completely out of it. Probably by 73.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they probably had advisors and stuff up to then.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, matter of fact, I think I've read where the Army was pretty well out of it by about 73.
Mm-hmm. Did you think the Vietnamese were capable of continuing the PBR program?
I don't know. They started that when I left.
Okay.
The guys that came in, I'm sure they were. You know, they... Vietnamese, just like anyone else, they were, some of them well educated, some of them were smart,
right.
Some of them were ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
If you put enough resources into training anyone, irregardless of what their race is, I think you're gonna come out with a well-rounded sailor or soldier.
Do you remember watching on TV the fall of Saigon in April 1975?
Yes, I did.
How did you feel about that?
Well, you feel disappointed and betrayed. You know, this personally, I know probably 20 guys that got killed over there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like guys from neighborhood, school,
right.
And military.
Right.
And, I just don't, you know, I don't think the Vietnam people got their just due. You know, I don't think they got the respect that they should have got.
The South Vietnamese?
The American soldiers.
The American
sailors,
soldiers, okay.
The airmen, whatever, Marines.
Okay.
You know, we pretty disappointed. And basically what I think that is the United States chickened out, and Chinese picked the pace up.
Okay. How do you think the Chinese picked the pace up?
Oh, absolutely. I think the Chinese furnished pilots,
mm-hmm.
manpower, weapons,
mm-hmm.
money.
Mm-hmm. So as soon as we were out of the fight, they stepped it up?
They stepped it up, absolutely.
Okay. What can the United States learn from the Vietnam experience? It's very relevant today.
Very relevant today. If you're not willing to expend the manpower and the resources to get the job done,
mm-hmm.
don't start it.
Okay. Do you think that the one of the common complaints about the leadership, the American leadership, was that in Washington, D.C., you know, they were basically running the war and not letting the military who were on the ground, in the water, in the air over there run it. Do you think that would have made a difference, or do you think the people in Washington are trying to do the best they could? Or
I don't think. I think that civilians should make the ultimate decision.
Right.
On where to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
And probably on how they're going to apply the war, you know, like on what type of weapons to use.
Right.
But I think when they make that decision, I think they need to turn over the military. That's probably like a house painter going to come in and do the plumbing.
Right.
I don't think civilians. You know, I'm not knocking education or nothing.
Right.
But I think I've got entirely too much harder than Yale and the government in the last few years.
Okay.
And probably the post Second World War.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States since your time in the country?
No, sir, don't.
Okay. What do you think about Vietnam today?
Probably a communist country.
Okay.
I don't think they're probably much better off than they were back then.
Mm-hmm.
South Vietnam is not as well off, and I don't think probably North Vietnam has changed any.
Mm-hmm. When you're looking back at your service, you mentioned you listen to music and things like that. One thing I like to ask veterans is, any particular music or musical group or song that reminds you of Vietnam, your service there?
Black is Black.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, okay. I remember that song. I listened to it, and, you know, probably during the Black is Black and I Want My Baby Back or some junk like that.
Uh-huh. That's exactly how it is.
Yeah.
Anything else, any other songs, any groups that you listen to a lot?
No, I like CCR, but I listen to them mostly when I got back home.
Okay. Okay. How about books on Vietnam? What do you think are the better books on Vietnam?
Well, I like James Webb pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about fiction or nonfiction?
Well, either. Whatever. What you think? If I were to pick up, if I wanted to read about Vietnam War, what do you think I should be reading?
Well, the Vietnam War.
Or about soldiers' experience there. Navy experience there.
I've never read any books on the naval experience.
Mm-hmm.
I read Webb's books,
mm-hmm.
and I read the book Stolen Valor,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, I read that Papa Bravo Romeo.
Right.
Did you read that?
No, sir, I have not, but I'm familiar with it.
I read that, but that was probably, I would probably come near, you know, the gas crashed a lot of people. But he wrote a pretty good book.
Mm-hmm.
If he left the negative statements out,
mm-hmm.
that would probably come nearer to us than anything probably that I've read.
Okay. How about the movies on Vietnam? You know, they've been coming out, I guess, since the late 70s. Which ones do you think are more authentic?
I've heard that I read the book, Now We Were Soldiers Once in Young.
Yes, sir.
I read that book, and that was a good book.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that book. I've never seen the movie yet, but I've heard that movie was probably the best one. The only movie I've ever seen, I've seen that Deer Slayer.
Deer Hunter.
Deer Hunter.
Yes, sir.
Deer Hunter, I didn't think it was worth a crap.
Okay.
I've seen that Apocalypse Now.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think much of it. And I've seen that movie Platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we didn't have I would probably have been more in line with a World War II
right.
Army outfit than it was with us.
Right.
But, actually, I hadn't seen any movies that would on the Navy.
Right. There are not that many, actually, I don't think. For young people today, what would you tell them or teach them about Vietnam?
You're talking about the outcome of it? Or?
Well, just anything. If you walked into a classroom.
If I walked into a classroom, I would send, the NBC newscaster, Brokaw,
mm-hmm.
he wrote the book about the greatest generation.
Yes, sir.
I don't agree with that. I think the greatest generation is the now generation. If you can't learn the lessons from your predecessors,
mm-hmm.
you're a lost species.
Okay.
I think the greatest generation we got now is our young people.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we were the young people, we were the greatest generation.
Okay.
And I think we did an excellent job.
Okay.
A diverse society and as many home problems as we had during the 60s mm-hmm. and early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I think the people that went over there, it didn't matter religion, race, whatever,
mm-hmm.
I think the people did an excellent job.
Okay.
And most of the guys that went over there are very proud of it. Most of them I've ever talked to.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very, very proud of their military time.
Yes. Is that how you feel about your service in Vietnam?
Absolutely.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or say for the record?
I'd just like to say that I appreciate you guys doing this. And I think you're doing a great service.
Thank you.
And I'm sure that all the guys do. As a matter of fact, I got on there. I found this on a website, mm-hmm. Texas Tech.
Yes, sir.
What you guys do.
Yes, sir.
And I met one of your buddies. I can't think of his name, mm-hmm. but he came to the Game Warden reunion in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Steve Maxner.
Yeah, I see him. Sure is.
Right, yes.
And I think you guys are doing a great job. We all guys really, really appreciate it.
Well, it's something we believe fully in, and we want to make sure we get your accounts on the record. And I certainly appreciate our conversation this evening.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Hold on just a second, sir, while I stop this. And this will conclude our oral history interview with Mr. David White.